Hi, this is John Hockenberry. For millions of Americans, the sound of violins and a railroad carriage are their ticket back to a Sunday evening spent in the early 20th century. A dying empire, a shrinking fortune, a vast aging country mansion, but a world of manners and customs, proper values, and people who know their places, alive and well.
You do know I mean to involve you in the running of the estate.
Oh, don't worry. There are plenty of hours in the day. And, of course, I'll have the weekend.
What is a weekend?
Downton Abbey. Hard to believe it's only been with us since 2011. With the arrival of Season 6 in the U.S., the curtain will fall for the last time on a television event that seems as permanent as Stonehenge. Downton Abbey, a realm where leisure doesn't have to be fun and where work just gets done. Don't ask the folks upstairs how. So many rules, so little logic. Upstairs is one world.
One can't go to pieces at the death of every foreigner. We'd all be in a state of collapse whenever we opened a newspaper.
And downstairs another.
Oh, what a day this has turned out to be.
Why?
Nanny West has been sacked. So that's fun for tomorrow.
Understanding these parallel worlds of the baronesses and scullery maids, the footmen and the butlers, is the charm and entertainment of Downton Abbey. Its awards include a dozen Emmys, Golden Globes. The PBS network has never aired a more popular series. For the next hour, and we promise no spoilers, we'll look behind the curtain, behind the curtain, behind the curtain at Downton and the man behind all of the curtains who knows class and the Crawley family tree, who can explain how, for formality, the American aristocracy can't be topped, and who will tell us about the real-life inspiration for the fearless Dowager Countess of Grantham, played to a T by Dame Maggie Smith.
I don't like auctions, especially when I knew the house in the old days. I hate to see people's things piled up in a heap, like so much rubbish.
Well, you and I differ when it comes to the importance of things.
Does it ever get cold on the moral high ground?
That's right, the man who created this entire world, Julian Fellowes. Fellowes is the creator and sole writer for Downton, but there is no final season 6 finale for this Dickensian juggernaut. Fellowes has teamed up with Andrew Lloyd Webber to write the book for the musical School of Rock, based on Richard Linklater's famous film of the same name.
Piano man, front and center. Just give this a try on my count, all right? One, two, three, four. Yeah. Come on, come on, come on, come on, now touch me, babe. Ba-da-ba-da, can't you see that I am not afraid? Shaka-ka-ka. Lawrence is good at piano. He shall be rocking in my show. Ra-ga-ga-ga. Stop. That's perfect. You're perfect. Stay right there.
School of Rock the Musical is on Broadway now. And that's just where our conversation started. Fellows joined me late last year in front of a live audience at the Green Space here at WNYC in New York City. This dapper dresser with an accent of cut glass finished in deep mahogany and a vocabulary from Harrods, he couldn't be more removed from the awesomeness, loserish, slang metal world in the School of Rock. Julian Fellowes is either Mr. Julian Fellowes, or if we're being formal, Baron Fellowes of West Stafford. He is not, nor ever will be, a dude.
That or, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
So what on earth told Lloyd Webber that this delicate cucumber sandwich of a writer would be perfect for something as dude-heavy as School of Rock?
I can't really answer that. I mean, I don't really know why anyone's ever offered me a job. But I imagine that he wanted to slightly open the story up and broaden its appeal slightly. And give an insight into some of the other characters. I mean, the film is very much about Dewey Finn, played wonderfully by Jack Black, who completely made it his own, is absolutely marvellous in it. But you don't know that much about the other people
right.
In the story, and in the show you know much more. I think that was probably my main job.
You have a rock and roll background. I mean, it said in the New Yorker profile that was, I urge you all to read, do you really not know who Ozzy Osbourne is, by the way?
No, of course I know who Ozzy Osbourne
is. Of course you know, right, because
they always do
that
sort of stuff. It's all nonsense.
Yeah, it's all.
Because they want you to be an idiot, in a way. And, of course, sometimes one obliges them by being an idiot. But, I know who Ozzy Osbourne is. But, I mean, I was young in the 60s.
Right.
And it wasn't possible to go through the 60s without being musical aware, because it was all about music. And it was the language of the young, and it was the release of this new animal, the teenager, and all of that stuff. And, you know, we were coming out of the 50s where our mothers didn't leave the house without a hat and gloves, and suddenly we were in the era of Je T'aime. You know, everything changed very, very fast. And it changed on the back of music. Music was the language of that change. And I remember being aware of it, actually. I mean, I had one brother. I've got lots of brothers, but I had one brother who was a real, you know, he flew to India and became a Buddhist, and the, you know, the whole 60s thing. But I wasn't like that. But I was aware that we were going through quite a distinct period of history, of social change, that things would not be the same at the end of it. And I did actually go off to Hammersmith to see the Beatles. And I went to Brighton to see the Rolling Stones because I thought these are the two bands of this time that will be remembered. And I wanted to see them live.
How old were you when you did?
Well, I suppose I was about, you know, 16, 17, something like that.
And you were saying to yourself, these are the two bands. You weren't just like, let's get some weed and go hang out at the concert. The Beatles are playing. Let's go check it out.
No, I was born old.
It intrigues me when you talk about so much social change happening on the backs of music in the 60s, and you were aware of that. Because in so many ways, if you think about what School of Rock is about and what it draws upon in you and what Downton Abbey is about, it's also about social change happening amidst a set that is trying to present the picture that, no, nothing is actually changing. And that if you look at the nostalgia for the British sort of Edwardian era in Waugh, in so many of the writers who've written about, you know, Brideshead Revisited, the Upstairs Downstairs series, which was very, very successful, and then come all the way to Downton. We're really talking about this change, this nostalgia for a time that no one today really understands, about Britain's, you know, supremacy in the world, and there's a continual sort of going back to that fount on some level. What do all those things have in common, do you think?
Well, I think there is a sort of feeling when you watch Downton or Upstairs Downstairs or any of them, there is a feeling that this was somehow a kind of safer world. You may disapprove of it, you may disapprove of the class system or any of the other stuff, but there was a kind of security in it. And of course, when you watch it on television, you get period light. You know, you enjoy the 1900s, but you don't have to get up at five and go and clean the grates. You know, that's not part of it. If you're part of the family, you look at their lovely clothes, but you don't have to change your own clothes five times a day and squeeze into a corset and all the rest of it. So all the time, we're getting the sort of charming version of it without actually having to live it. But I think there is a desire for security. We live in quite a shapeless society now. We live in the era of casual chic, you know. What does that mean? Those invitations, you think, just tell me what I'm to wear, you know, don't make me guess. Just say, black tie, suits, I don't care. Bathing suit, anything.
I was terrified to come down here. I figured I should just buy a three-piece suit to come and sit on the same stage with you. I was like, oh my God, I have nothing in my closet.
But I think that does appeal. But of course, in a way, it's quite false because all eras are eras of change, either fast change or slow change. And actually, that era, that period before the First World War, an enormous amount of social change was boiling up, about to happen. I mean, the whole role of women, for a start. A great many people, by the beginning of the First World War, knew that votes for women, everything, was completely inevitable. I mean, you had Asquith and others digging in, but it was nonsense that they were digging in. And, you know, later, after the war, the government chose to say, oh, well, as a reward for all the work that women have done in the war effort, we're now going to give some of them the vote, you know, and you have to be over 30 and a property owner and not a servant and all this palaver. But the truth of the matter was, it was out of date that women didn't have a vote in that society. And that had been rumbling and rumbling on for decades by the time it came. Then organized labor, you know, and also not just the revolutionary elements, but transport, the way, you know, entertainment, the moving picture, the aeroplane, you know, it was all hovering above that society. And by the end of the First World War, it had all really begun to happen. And so that period, like many, like the late 30s, there were changes in them ready to happen, and the war released them.
In so many ways, Downton Abbey is about time, stopping it and seeing how it can never stop.
To be honest, I'm starting to ask myself how much longer we can go on with it all.
We'll go on with what?
The household, the servants.
You're not in difficulties, are you?
No, but a butler, under-butler, footman, a valet, ladies' maids, to say nothing of the housemaids, the kitchen, the laundry, the gardens.
Yes, well, you think it's a bit too much in 1925.
The wage bill is three times what it was before the war.
It's the comedy and tragedy of the British Edwardian Victorian male world coming to its knees in the rapidly changing 20th century. But all the characters have real-life models. Our conversation turned to class and the real-life inspiration for Violet Grantham, the Dowager Countess, who rails against the new and glories in the way things used to be. Fellows reveals a bit about his mind when he conveys that Downton's storylines and character development were all stored in the spreadsheet of his own mind. Nothing left to chance or inspiration. Not least how the whole thing starts, anyway. Fellows says the precise setting he chose for the very first season was entirely calculated.
I mean, we quite deliberately started the series in 1912 because we knew if it had any legs, and there were other series, we would have the first three completely contrasting, because we'd have the first one before the war, which, even though King Edward was dead, was still the end of the Edwardian era.
Right.
Then the second series was bound to be in the war, and we knew we didn't want more than one series in the war, so we started that halfway through it with a two-year gap. And then the third series was England after the war and the beginning of the 20s, which was, you know, a very different feeling and mood and so on. So we knew that change was going to be a very central theme of the show from the beginning, and eventually change would hit even the walls of Downton Abbey and the life as it was lived. I mean, I didn't want to show any members of that world as villainous per se. I think that is bogus. I don't think there is a class that is evil any more than there is a nationality that is evil. Most people, in my philosophy anyway, most people are trying to do their best and get through their lives as well as they can and hopefully provide for their families and have a decent time of it. And I think that's true if they are cleaning offices at night or living on Park Avenue with millionaire husbands. They're just trying to get through it as well as they can. And I think that is the philosophy that informs the show.
We'll come back to some of those details of the show in a moment. But to talk about your life a little bit, we're keenly aware of the hierarchies in Downton. You know, who's on top, who's not, you know, the house staff, and in terms of who's in the Grantham.
Of course, the gradations of the servants were really more severe because the family and their friends, by definition, were all social equals,
yes,
really.
Yes.
And although that was a convention, polite society, that a gentleman's daughter would be unlikely to marry a duke, even in that period, but nevertheless, for the purposes of society, for a dinner party, for a ball, they were all equal. That was not true in the servants' hall.
No. Although I do recall that, you know, lawyers have a particularly bad place in this sort of... lawyers were not invited to the parties.
Well, actually, that's not completely
barristers,
true.
Barristers, I guess.
There is a sort of myth that the children, the younger sons of the gentry and the nobility, there were only the army, the navy, the church.
Right.
And that was all there was for them to do. But actually, there was a bit of them going into law. So that, you know, it was also a gentleman's profession, but it was just slightly unusual.
A little questionable.
And it's like the banking families were, you know, in many cases very, very rich, but it was sort of, they were banking families, and that was slightly different as opposed to just being landed. So, of course, what they did mostly was buy big estates so they could run around
right.
worrying about their estates and seem more normal to their contemporaries.
It wasn't effortless like the true lords and the true royalty.
Yes, I mean...
Banking had a certain utility to it. It wasn't plumbing exactly, but it was something you had to do.
I think the strength of the American aristocracy, actually, is that they never felt the need to separate themselves from the source of their money. Mm. So they would become, you know, Vanderbilt, and they'd become railway kings and kings of oil and kings of shipping and, you know, whatever. But they didn't do what the British did, which was when they'd made the money, sell the company, get a baronetcy and rush off to Cumberland and try to persuade everyone they were Plantagenets. The Americans didn't fall into that.
I guess the Clintons are trying to start it, I suppose.
But I mean, the Americans had a more realistic upper class that transferred more easily into the 20th century because the concept of work here was compatible with being at the very top of society. And Europe, that was quite rare.
Now, you're doing a project with Universal on the Gilded Age.
Right? I am.
Which would take some of your knowledge that you've just shown us and your skill in Downton and try to explore this other American realm. Okay. And you don't have the house staff, kind of the orderliness of the house staff and the families as you would have.
I wouldn't say that, actually. America in the 1870s, 80s, 90s was very, very formal. I mean, they had more costumes for different activities than even the British. And they lived this extraordinary regulated formal life. I mean, like Newport, where they would build, you all know, the so-called cottages, which are vast houses, but unlike England, vast houses with no land. They would sit in 10 acres.
And tennis courts.
Huge houses with tennis courts and all the rest of it, but essentially no estate. But in those lives, I mean, they would go to Newport, in theory, for their sort of summer holiday, but that holiday you'd be in white tie every night at a banquet eating off gold plate with a footman standing behind your chair, far more than at that time in England. And so people, you know, the Duke of Marlborough, whatever, came out to marry Consuelo Vanderbilt, you know, the terrifying Alva Vanderbilt's daughter. And, I mean, he was absolutely amazed at the splendor of Newport, and he lived at Blenheim. I mean, you know, so America's now have this tremendous thing about informality. And they always say, oh, let's wear a tie, you can take that off. Yeah. I mean, that's quite recent.
Right.
When I first came here, when I was 21, and that was in 1970, you always had to pack a dinner jacket because at least three or four things while you were here would be black tie. But now I'm not conscious of having put on a black tie in the last 15 or 20 years for anything except awards dinners, you know, Emmy night and that sort of thing. But never at a private dinner anymore. It probably means I'm moving in rather humble circles.
I think someone is going to now correct me. No, there's not a lot of that going on.
But I think it's changed here.
Everything's cocktail, you know, informality. There's a tremendous sense in the corporate world, don't wear a tie. That's like the status.
And dressing down Fridays and all those things when you come in looking as if you're going to the beach. I don't really get that. If I went to see my banker and he rolled in a T-shirt and sand-coloured cotton trousers, I'd think my money is not in safe hands.
I want
my banker to look dull and straight in some horrible suit.
So where are you in the hierarchy in Britain when you were growing up? You went to boarding school, right?
Yes, of course, the British press has only basically got two pasts for you. Either you grow up in a palace with 27 servants,
right,
or you grow up under a sheet of corrugated iron somewhere on the M1. They don't really have anything in between that. But most people are in between that. And, I mean, I came, I suppose, from the sort of bottom of the top. We didn't have much money. My grandfather was a younger son. And what, in a way, gave me a sort of look at all this stuff, which I think I'm more aware of now. I don't think I was at all aware of it when I was younger. But my father came from one of those families, you know, a minor one, but I mean in the books. And my mother did not. My mother was the daughter of a civil servant, and came from a perfectly respectable middle-class background. I now know that my father's family couldn't stand her. And they thought she'd caught him. She was very, very good-looking. Very good-looking. She looked rather like... Do you remember Jean Tierney? Oh, yeah.
Mm.
She looked rather like Jean Tierney, and people used to want to paint her and all that sort of thing. And I don't know whether she caught him or not. I mean, they were very happy. What else matters? But my father's aunts and things would always sort of freeze when she came in. She wasn't part of the gang. She wasn't part of the club. And I think, to be honest, looking back, I think it caused her a degree of unhappiness over the years. And my father was a diplomat, and then he went into Shell. And a lot of that involved being posted to Egypt, where I was born, to Kenya, where my brother was born, and then eventually my father was head of Shell in Nigeria. And for my mother, these postings were paradise, because she got out of it. She got away from the whole English game, and she could just be who she was. And I think as I grew older, I started to understand the game that was being played around. And, you know, with class, class can make people very unhappy. And the exclusion of class can ruin lives. We now like to trivialize it. We say, oh, it doesn't matter anymore. Who cares about any of that? But that's all very well as a general observation. But with an individual life, you know, it's very tough. And you always have to keep smiling and not apparently noticing the slights. And, you know, I saw that. I saw it close up. And I think that did give me a curiosity about the system. And the funny thing about your child, you probably all know this, but as you get older, your childhood becomes more comprehensible to you. You look back at these people who you knew very well, obviously, but you didn't quite know them as well as you know them now. And you see their motives, and you see their unkindnesses. I mean, I loved my great aunts, and one of them was the model for Violet Grantham, and also for Maggie Smith's character in Gosford Park. You know, she was very tough. They have such similar names, aren't they? Lady Grantham and Lady Trentham. I never noticed that until quite recently. But anyway, that, you know, they were both based on her, and she was tough on others, but tough on herself, which is why those characters are sort of acceptable. But she was hard. She was hard on my mother.
To come, we'll find out more about the role of some of the other women in the series, not least the intervention of the American heiress.
Don't worry about me, I'm an American, have gun with travel.
Come war and peace, Downton still stands and the Crawleys are still in it.
More highbrow, or just brow, with Julian Fellowes coming up. This is John Hockenberry in conversation with the creator and sole writer of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes. You no doubt know there's an American invasion in Downton Abbey, and it's both an exploration of some real history and a device for the auteur. Cora Crawley, Countess of Grantham, Viscountess Downton, the American heiress daughter of Martha and Isidore Levinson. Fans will know that Cora's mother turns up in season 3, played by the unstoppable Shirley MacLaine. And while Martha divides her time between New York and Rhode Island, Cora opted for a life abroad, bringing herself and her huge fortune to the shores of the UK. Not long after she marries Robert Crawley, the Earl of Grantham, in an impulse of romantic pragmatism, their hybrid daughters arrive, each expressing qualities from both sides of the Atlantic, the proper and responsible tragic Mary, the upright feminist Edith, and the James Dean renegade, Sybil. For Julian Fellowes, Lady Grantham is a useful device for throwing an outsider perspective into the whole mix.
Cora was a different thing. That I was reading a book called To Marry an English Lord, quite a funny book, about those heiresses who came over from America and married into English upper-class families. There were quite a lot of them, actually. There were about 350 of them. So they were sort of group within a group. And they were there to save, or at least, as it turned out, delay the fall of this way of life. And as I was reading it, I found myself thinking, you know, we know all about those lovely debutantes tripping down the gangplank into the arms of the Duke of Manchester or the Duke of Roxburgh or the Duke of Marlborough. Actually, they were miserable, but the others, some of the others were happy. And how lovely it was. But I thought, what was it like 20 years later when they were sitting in some freezing house in Staffordshire, you know, and getting a letter from their sister on Long Island, you know, and thinking, oh, wouldn't I be back there? But I don't know. And I also think, and this is true now, when you marry a foreigner and you agree to live in their country, a man or woman, you are going to have foreign children. You are going to have children of a different nationality to you. And they will have different prejudices and different assumptions. And I think it's quite testing that. I think it takes quite a large personality to be comfortable being a foreigner their whole life. I always admire it because I don't think I've got it. I came to England, I lived in America in the early 80s for a couple of years. I had a nice time, I lived on the West Coast, I got a certain amount of work, it was fun. But in the end, I felt I was always having to explain myself. Do you know what I mean? Explain, in the modern phrase, where I was coming from. And I just got tired of it. And in the end, I was getting more work in England, and I went back. And so it left me with a lasting admiration for people who do that and who make it work for them. And also, I wanted a character at the centre of the story, or more than one, who could be in the middle of it, but critical of it. And not dyed in the wool. And by putting an American wife into the whole thing, I had a character who initially she kind of accepts it all and she sort of sucks it in, but every now and then she sticks up for her own values. But as the world changes and moves actually nearer the America of her own youth in the 1880s, she becomes more outspoken because she is more in tune with the changes that are happening than her husband is. And I knew that from the start. And that's also why we had the situation of the three daughters, because, funnily enough, that was taken from life. That was taken from a friend of mine who was the heir to a title. And his father's second cousin, so it wasn't near, he grew up in South Africa, decided to bring him from South Africa to England as a 19-year-old man, to get used to the whole idea before he inherited everything. And he had to get on with, in that case, four sisters. And that was the inspiration of the whole Matthew story. But what I realized about my pal was that he approached this marvelous house, fantastic house, one of England's great palaces, but with a totally fresh outlook. He hadn't spent his childhood there and taken it all for granted. He came over the brow of the hill and the drive, and there was this sitting there, you know, and he fell in love with it, and he made it work. And actually, he's dead now, but he really gave that house a golden era that it had not known since the 18th century. It was fantastic what he did. And I think that was because he was an outsider and not just, you know, one of the run and are we hunting on Thursday. He was approaching the whole thing as a challenge. And I wanted the heir to be from a different setup. And so he grew up. I mean, yes, he was a member of an aristocratic family because that's why he was the heir. But it was sufficiently distant that he'd grown up as an intellectual middle class lawyer and not, as you know, just taking it all for granted. And so that gave me two characters at the heart of the story who were not necessarily going to go along with the prejudices of Lord Grantham and his daughters. And that, you know, seemed to set up a sort of tension. I mean, all the time when you're doing this stuff, you're trying to find where the tension is next, who's going to be cross with who next. And, you know, that gave me a sort of built-in tension. And also, you know, because I wanted Mary and Matthew to end up romantic. But, in the old phrase of Hollywood, you know, they have to meet cute. And in a way, meeting cute means meeting not as lovers or not even as people who like each other, because then you've got the whole journey to make with them. If they take one look at each other and adore each other, there's not a lot to say about it. But you deliberately make that not happen. And so by placing them in different places philosophically and even politically, then you've got a sort of built-in thing to work through.
If there was some giant cricket match or softball game or, you know, soccer game between the cast members of Downton Abbey, and on one team was the staff, and on the other team were all the royals and heiresses and people in the book, what jersey would you wear?
No, I can't see myself as much of a jersey man.
Come on, really. What team would you be on?
Which team would I be on? No, I'd be the umpire.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Well done. Well done.
Actually, our cricket enthusiast is Jim Carty. He's absolutely mad. Carson. Mad about cricket. And kept asking for a cricket plot. And we did actually... We had a cricket plot where the whole house played the village, which was another... That was quite ordinary as well. You weren't... It wasn't necessarily staff versus family. It was quite often house versus village, or house versus estate workers and so on. And he's terribly... He's a very talented cricketer, actually. So that was great, because we kept telling us what to do. You know, at least someone was on the pitch who knew what was happening.
Yeah.
So that was great.
A word about the cast... About your experience with the cast members. I mean, Maggie Smith, of course, you go way back with, but there are some just extraordinary actors and performers who've been a part of this cast. And as the Wikipedia page says, people, I mean, I could quiz you on, Jeremy Clyde. You know that name?
Jeremy Clyde, I know very well. And he played General something something in that dinner when Hugh had thought he was going to the front in the First World War, and he discovered he'd just been taken on as a kind of honorary member.
How about Trevor Cooper? Drawing a blank.
Trevor Cooper. I'm very glad you asked that question.
seriously, about the cast, the members that you've grown so familiar with and are writing for.
We had a fantastic cast. We had a very, very good casting director, Jill Trevelyk. And, you know, with the established... I mean, I had a few I wanted from before. Maggie, Hugh... Brendan, I wanted and wrote the parts for, but only a few. And after that, Jill lined them up. Well, of course, with people, Jim Carter, Phyllis Logan, you know, these are very established leading players in England. They may not have been so well known in America, but they're very well known in England. So as they come up, I thought, of course, you know, they're of it. That's perfect, you know. But the extraordinary thing for me was her finding of the young. Because I don't know who's out there. I mean, and she really kept her eye on what was coming out of the drama schools, what was happening. I mean, the only one of the young who had any real profile before Downton was Michelle, who plays Mary. Mm. And she had quite a big success at the National, playing Eliza in Pygmalion. Mm-hmm. And in a way, we profited from that because she learnt the accent that Mary would speak in. Which isn't her true voice. I mean, Mary is a completely invented characterization, which is rather extraordinary, actually.
It's amazing.
When you know that. She'd started. But the others, I mean, Laura Carmichael, who plays Edith, the luckless Edith, that was her first job. And I mean, she left drama school. She got a job, in a doctor's receptionist in order that she might eat. And she was trying to get auditions, and she got one. But, you know, there is a story. She'd done an audition for a sort of Shakespeare tour in somewhere abroad, I can't remember. And she also did the initial interview for Downton. And she'd been recalled for Downton, but there hadn't been a decision. And the tour rang up and said... to her agent, you know, we are offering her this part. And the agent said, look, The thing is, she's up for another part in a big TV, ITV series, which really might change her career. So could you possibly wait until she hears from them and before she gives you the answer? And they said, no. No, she has to answer now. Which is, you know, please, come on. What is it going to be, 2 days? You just, that stuff makes you so irritated. Because it's so self-important. You just go, calm down. But anyway, with, I think, immense bravery, she turned them down. Because she said to herself, I can't miss the chance of this. Even though I'm probably not going to get it, I can't miss the chance of it. And then she did get it. So, which I like, because, you know, it's nice when people are brave and then their bravery is rewarded. I mean, it isn't always, but in that case it was. But, you know, aren't people unnecessarily mean? You know, can I park here? No.
How long have you been in New York on this stint? finally, then, your Emmy acceptance speech for the first run of Downton was such an amazing piece of thank you so much for seeing what I saw. Thank you so much for vindicating a vision that I've been carrying around. It was such a warm sense of, wow, you got it.
When we were in the hotel a bit earlier, my wife said to me, I think we should just relax and enjoy the evening because I don't think we're going to win. Well, we're going to enjoy the evening now. I would like to thank you, the American industry. 10 years ago, you kick-started my second career with an Oscar. Tonight, you have nurtured it. I am very grateful. Thank you.
You know, I mean, getting awards is great, you know. And because there's something a bit surreal about it. You know, we all spend a lot of time accepting shampoo bottles, you know, in the shower. I'd like to thank my mother, you know. And there is something very strange about it really being true, you know. And you go up on that huge, shiny stage and you turn around and there are more people than you've ever seen in your life. It's very kind of surreal. I do think they are sort of up there in those kind of markers of one's life. And,
well,
and
in particular, it was such a... You brought such a sense of this people will like and nobody knew it, but now we can't imagine not having it.
Well, of course, not
and
all that many people
gift.
Had seen it at that point, because I got off the aeroplane and my agent, whom I love, said to me, no chance this year, but it'll really set it up for next year. So I'd gone into the awards ceremony, he said, because nobody's watched it. And so I'd gone in and I'd got that face, because I had the same with Oscars. Everyone kept saying, such a shame you're up against Memento. And I got this even from my agent. Thanks. And so I got my face into that kind of, what a good choice, you know, so that you didn't look as if you were going...
Yeah.
So,
and
so you sort of... And if you actually...
Do you do that in the shower? Do you practice that in the shower?
No, yeah. I practice. But in the film of me winning the Oscar, if you look at it... On the inside of it, still there, but there's a moment when I had so accepted that I hadn't won that I sort of didn't hear it. So, and the Oscar goes to, because nobody can say the winner, that's all gone, nobody's a winner. But the Oscar goes to, and I. And then my wife leans over and says, in real life, it's you, it's you! And you can see me going, oh! And then sort of racing up to the stage. God, it was an extraordinary... And I hadn't prepared a speech for that for two reasons. Because one, I thought it was unlucky. And the other was I didn't think I'd won it.
Still to come, less of me and more from the audience. Their questions on writing, on character development, and who gets to inherit the family china.
Thank you.
This is John Hockenberry. We're giving you some of the highlights from a conversation that took place late last year here in New York with Julian Fellowes, the creator and sole writer behind Downton Abbey. The sixth season is the last. The journey that began in 1912 ends in 1927. But as we're about to hear, the way the program looks, the pace of the various plot lines is more 21st century than early 20th. At the time when we recorded our conversation at the Green Space here at WNYC, I promised the audience there, and I promise you now, that there will be no huge spoilers. One thing that Fellows would discuss was how much new money it takes to show old money in its heyday. $1 million an episode to make a scene like this believable. Two aging betrothed members of the household staff needing both a feisty and a fearless cook to do some coaching of their sex lives after the wedding.
She needs to know if that's what you anticipate. A full marriage.
As opposed to...
living together in companionship, I suppose. In friendship. Warm friendship, I'm sure.
Is that what she's offering? Warm friendship?
She has to know what you expect.
Our hour concluded with questions from some of those in the audience who would easily have stayed for another hour. Many diehard Downton fans who knew the cast of characters inside out and back to front.
My name is Steve Ettlinger. I noticed with great displeasure that there are very few episodes in each series. There's only, it seems like, a handful. I'd like to see it. Well, many more episodes.
I'm doing my best.
Yeah, well, thank you. Better get on it. And as a result, the plots move along very quickly. They're by leaps and bounds sometimes. Is that a pleasure or a constraint, a challenge for you?
Well, I think those are two separate questions, actually. If you decide... I mean, we fooled around with the idea of having other writers in the first year. But we couldn't find anyone who could sort of get the rhythm of it in some way. I don't know why. But anyway, we couldn't. So it was clear that I was going to have to write all of it. And once one person is writing all of it, then, I mean, I was writing 11 hours of television because two episodes in England and an hour and a half, and the Christmas special is 2 hours. So it added up to 11 hours. And that is about as much as any one person can write in for one season. Once you go to 22 episodes, then you go to a writing room. That is just, that's part of the process. And not that I'm in the least against a writing room. I admire writing. I mean, Matthew Weiner, who runs Mad Men and is the principal writer on Mad Men, I was full of admiration because he had a writing room, but the style of the show never flickered. I mean, he kept it absolutely definite, completely. You could see Mad Men was this extraordinary, iconic style. And so I don't think it's the easy option. I think it's very hard work. But the point I'm making is just that it's not possible to only have one writer for much more than 10 or 11 hours. So that was the decision. As for the speed, I mean, some plots go quickly, some go slowly. And we have long plots that go right through the series, and we have other plots that have four scenes and then they're resolved. And it's a kind of mixture of the two. I mean, I do think that things have speeded up in television. And when I look at Jewel in the Crown or Brideshead, two perfectly wonderful series, but to a modern viewer in their 20s, they would find both of them more or less unwatchably slow. Because in those days, you could get up, you could go to the kitchen, make a cup of coffee, make a sandwich, answer a call, come back, and, you know, you pick it up. But yeah. Now, you know, you go out to answer the door, you come back, someone's dead. You know? And so it's just a different era, really, in television. I mean, where I think we, not a trick exactly, but Downton looks like a traditional British period series and everyone wears lovely clothes and Maggie Smith says funny things and so on. But the model for it is really the American revolution in television that came about with ER and West Wing and so on, where you've got all these things happening and everyone's walking down the corridor. And that's the structure. So even though they're in corsets and waiting for the footman to come to their left, it's ER that is it's based on.
But and, you, if you go too fast, they're going to trip and kill themselves.
I know,
though,
no,
that Aaron Sorkin stuff.
They have to be careful. Although that's an idea.
ER on the Thames.
I'm not proud.
Much. Yeah. I mean, I did leave the room once, and the character who Lady Mary was in love with, who came back from the war paralyzed, was able to walk again.
I know.
And I was just getting to, like, oh, he's going to be my wheelchair buddy, yeah. And no, now he's walking. No. In truth, you don't get to write a series like Downton Abbey as well as it's been written without some insider knowledge. And for Fellows, who we heard earlier describes himself as coming from the bottom of the top, the landed and ennobled are not strangers to him or his family, and his aristocratic lineage was most clear when questions over inheritance and etiquette arose, such as how does one's driver properly respond to the most rotten of British weather?
I had a great, great aunt, my father's great aunt, who was called Lady Sydenham, and she thought that for the chauffeur to mind about the weather was ridiculous and spoiling.
Yes,
so my poor parents, who were much milder and kinder than Daddy's aunt, used to have to sit in the back of this car when they'd been met off the train, watching this man driving along in the kind of lashing rain. And there was, in fact, a sort of tarpaulin you could pull out. And they used to say to him, he was called Church, and they used to say to him, look, please pull it out and then put it back just before we go into the drive.
Right.
And, I mean, that was completely true.
Well, in Gosford, they did pull
They did pull it. Yes, they did pull it out. They anyway, were a little more kind. Actually, if you look at that film, it's rather interesting. It's something no one will tell you. Every single shot in that film is moving. And it's just always a moving camera, always moving at the same speed, so you wouldn't cut from one to the other, because that's the important skill of it. You can only cut from a moving shot if you cut to a moving shot. Every shot is moving, except for one. And that was because they sent out the second unit. When they cut the scene you're talking about, when the lady's maid is waiting in the rain for Maggie to get in before she can get into the car, and you have one shot through the car of the maid getting wet in the rain.
Yes.
And it's completely stationary. And what had happened is that we cut the scene and we realized we'd forgotten this cover shot of the maid. Ah. And they sent out the second unit to get it, but nobody explained it had to move.
Oh, how
so
funny.
I feel that's a sort of question for one of those quizzes on television.
Yeah. Well, you'll go home and put it on the Wikipedia page and for Gosford, right? Any number of you here will
and
note
her
that.
Woolly hat that was getting so... But I actually did have a question, and that is this. I could ask somebody else, but more fun to ask you. I'm curious to know what happened in families such as yours or your aunt's, about the dishes. Did the spode come down forever and ever in the family? What happened if anybody actually needed china? Did they actually go and buy china?
Shall I repeat that? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you do with the china? Do you have to buy china if you go from generation to generation?
Oh, I see.
Are the patterns kept somewhere? Did your aunt ever have to buy china?
My wife and I have both been pretty lucky in inheriting things, furniture, picture. Because the sort of breakup in the 20s and 30s, when all those so many houses were sold and everyone gave up and it was all broken up and, maid and aunts got this. And we were both, before we knew each other, interested. And so we got quite a lot of stuff. And we have inherited quite a lot of china. But I did actually commission... I had a few plates of a fellow service that had been made in about 1840, German, which I thought was very pretty. And I did commission a dinner service as a copy, because now you can get people slaving away in China or something to do it. And and I did buy that. And I thought it was rather successful, actually. One of Emma's aunts.
I have to say, in my life, I have never sustained a conversation about China for this long.
Okay.
But I'm just, we're over the record now.
This
but
is
keep
quite
going.
Funny. Yeah. But Emma had a great aunt, and there was one service that she thought was absolutely marvellous and could not be trusted to go down to the kitchen and be washed up, because something would be broken. The only person who could wash this up was herself. And she used to use the plates more than once in the evening. And on one side of her seat, she would have a thing of clear water and on the other thing of soapy water. And she would, at the end of the first course, she'd say, plates, darlings, plates, plates. And these plates would be passed down. And then she would go, oof, like this, oof, like this, and then pass them back. But you never got the same plate back. So this plate would come back with traces of egg mousse and avocado and soap. And then everyone had to surreptitiously try to get their napkin up and try and clean it off. And that went on throughout Emma's childhood. But I don't know what became of the plates in the end.
Hi, my name is Ken Murphy. And just a question about the challenge of writing with so many hours and so many characters and so many plot lines, how you, your personal approach to writing, how you face the blank page, what kind of things you do in your own writing process.
What room are you in when you write?
Actually, one thing I'm very lucky about is when I first was asked, when I was first writing, because I made some children's series for the BBC before all this, and then I wrote Gosford, and I was still working as an actor. In fact, I was when I wrote Mary Poppins. And so I couldn't be precious about where I was doing it because I had to go where I was going. I was in a trailer or I was in digs in Scotland or I was on some location. I just had to write. So I never had that thing about, you know, I have to have my stuffed rabbit there and I can only have this mug, you know. That wasn't permitted to me. And so I can now write wherever, on a train, you know, I don't care. But it's hard really to talk about our sort of process. I mean, are you a writer?
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? You don't, in a way, you don't kind of know what you're doing. You only know that if you go on doing it, at some point you'll put the end and this agony will be over. But I, the one thing I do think, two things. One is I never wait until I feel like writing, because that way I'd never write anything. I go through to my desk, which in the country is in our billiard room, which is a long way down away from the main house, and so it's sort of quite quiet. And I go there and I just sit down and start writing. And in order to facilitate this, the day before, I always try and stop when I know what the next bit is. So I know what the next scene is. What I try not to do is to write to the very end of my imagination so I don't have a clue what the next bit is, because it's much harder to get started again the following day. But, you know, that's about my only gimmick. I mean, I sort of
sketch
out...
Besides the stuffed rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a stuffed rabbit, actually. But it's just an observer in my life, not a keen participant. But I do sketch out the episode. I do. And I have it... I write on Final Draft, so I have the synopsis sort of underneath it, and then I remove the bits of it as I've written them. And then I get to the end. Really what I try to do is I try to bang through until I write the end, because I find if you keep going back over the first 30 pages, you never get beyond them. And then I go back and rewrite everything. And also, with a show like this, I will check, I'll put in Mrs. Patmore into Find, and I'll start at page one, and I'll see she's on page one, she's on page seven, she's on page 10, 11, and 12, she's on page 16, she's on page 40. And then you think, ooh, I better go to somewhere around 25 and find a moment for Mrs. Patmore. And then I do that with all the characters so that I know they're all in play. Even if they don't have much to do in a scene, they're there, they're in play. They've got one comment. What is very important for our actors, and I always used to say this, used to say it because it's over now, but I always used to say, you have to be in charge of your own character, because you will have to take your stories through scenes that are about other stories, that are about three or four other stories, but you will be responsible for making sure that your character is still in the middle of what's happening to this episode. Mm. And they were very good at that. They were very, very good. They were always in the middle of their own storyline. And, you know, you rely on that. I mean, of course people, you know, if they like the script, that's great, but it is a collaborative thing with the actors in a series, because you're writing for performances that have already begun. You're feeding performances. And it's not the same as writing a film or a play or a musical or even a miniseries where the whole thing's written and done and dusted and then it's cast. You are deliberately... I mean, you get characters like Molesley, you know, who came in as quite a small part, but I so loved the poignancy that Kevin gave him, the kind of inner sorrow of this man for whom almost nothing ever worked out. And I started to write for that. And, you know, eventually he became quite a major figure in the show. And, I mean, I think that is part of series writing. You have to sort of stay loose a bit. But beyond that, I mean, I think my main piece of advice is just don't wait until you want to do it.
Julian Fellowes, award-winning writer and creator of Downton Abbey, Gosford Park, and his latest work can be seen on stage on Broadway, in fact, in the musical The School of Rock. We're grateful to him, the audience, and all those who helped us make this happen at the Green Space in New York City. Until next time, I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening.